I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of doing exactly the opposite of what you're asked to do and why that happens. You tell me if this sounds familiar. Gavin Fitzsimmons and Tanya Chartrand are husband and wife. Soon after they were married, Tanya noticed something odd but rather predictable about Gavin's behavior. If she asked him to do something, take out the trash, pick up some fish for dinner, it was as if he'd always look for a reason not to do it. Now, it's not like he wasn't helpful around the home, and this is what puzzled Tanya. It was just that Gavin was almost certain to resist a suggestion if it came from her. I told you this would sound familiar. Fortunately for the two of them, they are both professors of psychology and marketing at Duke University. So Tanya devised a scientific study to learn more about this reaction. Was it because she was nagging? Is it because Gavin's simply stubborn? The answer to both questions and my chance to talk with the two of them right after the news. We're going to learn a new word in this next conversation. Well, new to me anyway. The word is reactant. If you've ever told a two-year-old that she can't have that ice cream and suddenly she wants it more than life itself, your child is being reactant. Strangely enough, many of us never outgrow reactants, myself included. Say I come up with this idea to clean up the front yard. Then my wife suggests it might be nice if I cleaned up the front yard, and all of a sudden, I'm not that interested in getting the rake and the wheelbarrow. Why is that? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
I can only imagine that it's way more frustrating if you're the one who's trying to figure out why. Why it is that a significant other seems to do exactly the opposite of what it is you suggest. And they don't even seem to know they're doing it. Tanya Chartrand is a psychology professor at Duke University. She noticed this annoying habit in her new husband, Gavin Fitzsimmons, and it got her thinking. So she designed a research study. Now, this gets more interesting because her husband is also a psychology professor, and he worked on the study with Tanya. Now, when I looked at what they'd written in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, I saw this. In response to controlling significant others and among chronically reactant individuals, the non-conscious activation of relational representations can automatically elicit oppositional goal pursuits even when pursuit of an oppositional goal results in a personally suboptimal outcome. Uh-huh. I asked both Tanya Chartrand and Gavin Fitzsimmons to join me, to translate that, and to give me their best definition of what it is to be a reactant individual.
Reactance is a desire to be able to choose for yourself whenever you want. So you might have a series of different drinks that you might have at lunch. So you might think about having a water or a milk or a juice. And a reactant person would always want to be able to choose for themselves whether they have water, milk, or juice. If you took one of those choices away from them, so I said, Dick, today you can only have water or juice, all of a sudden,
you would desperately
want the milk, okay? And that's really what a reactant person is. When you remove some of their freedom to choose, they want it back.
So when people try to think about this, does it make sense to put it in teenage terms, where a teenager almost always chooses something in opposition to what the parents present?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there is some research demonstrating that teenagers tend to be more reactant in general than older adults.
Just because they want to get under their parents' skin? I mean, is that the kind of reaction we're talking about?
I think one of the elements of these chronically reactant people is that they tend to think that other people are trying to control them. And we found evidence for that in our study that these highly reactant people thought that all of their significant others were trying to control them all the time. And so that's why they were reacting against this. So teenagers probably think everyone's trying to control them. You know, their parents, their teachers, they're telling them what to do, what not to do. They feel controlled. And that's why I think they tend to be more highly reactant in general.
And when you think about like what would be the seeds of this feeling, teenagers, of course, they're getting to a point in life where they want to be able to make their own choices. And yet society, and in particular their parents, aren't letting them. Sort of creates this real desire, hey, I want to be able to choose. And then as we get older, some of us gravitate away from that. And, you know, like Tanya's really not a reactant person. She wouldn't mind if I said, well, do you want the water or the juice? She really wouldn't mind that she couldn't choose the milk. And then some of us, like myself, basically are grown-up teenagers in that respect. So if you said water or juice to me, boy, I'm furious that I can't have the milk.
And this is almost like a reaction that you can't suppress. You say, this is who I am.
It's
part of my character.
Exactly. That's my belief. So, yeah, we can get into our interpretations on that.
It's automatic and non-conscious in the sense that you're not aware that you're doing it, and you're not necessarily consciously intending to do it at the time. You're not saying, I'm going to do the opposite of what this person wants for me to do. So it's not a conscious response. Can you control it? I mean, maybe if it's brought to your attention, if you're made aware of it, like this research does, then perhaps you can control it with greater awareness. But it's automatic and non-conscious, at least initially.
So here you guys are trying to figure out why people react the way they do to various suggestions or hints and why the reactions are different. You're married. You must see this in your own relationship. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's fair to say.
Yes.
And so, Tanya, if you're not reactive, mm-hmm. can I say you're easygoing? You just sort of go with the flow?
Yeah. I'm actually a very indecisive person. And I think my guess is that indecisive people would tend to not be really reactant because, like, I like it when Gavin makes a lot of the more minor decisions of the day for us because that means it's one less thing I have to decide. And I don't like making decisions constantly. Important decisions are important to me. But
when you weigh in and make a decision that somehow may cross into Gavin's decision-making territory, then you know what about him? What's his reaction going to be?
Well, like, let's say we're going to see a movie. He'll say, well, what movie do you want to see? I'll say, whatever, or what TV show do you want to watch tonight? Doesn't really matter to me. It's one less decision I have to make if he just makes those decisions. But if it's something important, like how many kids we have, for instance, you know, those kinds of things, it's like I feel very strongly about a smaller number of things, and then he'll take those fairly seriously because, she means business here, which is the problem with when he has these very strong opinions about every little decision. It probably tends to dampen the attention that's given any one single, you know, decision that's being made because it's like, well, here we go again.
You bring out the machete every time there's a decision when you could be a little more laid back.
Yes,
right?
I think essentially that's the case. I think the trouble with relationships and sort of broader, you know, dynamics between people is that if you're a reactant person that likes to be able to make the choice yourself all the time and you're put into a relationship or a group context where you have to make a group decision or a couple decision, it's really hard for the reactant guy to give up the choice freedom.
But does it spill out into other areas, Gavin, if you're going to play a pickup basketball game and you have to come up with two guys who choose the teams? Do you want to be one of those two guys so you get to make the decision about who's on your team? Are you willing to sort of stand back and let someone else make all those decisions, or is that going to rile you a little bit?
I think in fairness, I'm getting a dirty look from my wife here, so I know what the real answer is.
You know what
is.
The proper
answer is. Yeah, no, I think the truth of the matter is that I would prefer to be in that choosing position all the time.
Let's talk about the academic study that you did, but before we get to it, the genesis, the idea, did it come over the dinner table going, why is it that we are the way we are? Is there a way of studying this? Or did it come from your own academic pursuits?
Well, I will say Gavin has been studying reactants in retail environments for 15 years. How do people react when they go to a store and their favorite brand of yogurt isn't there, for instance?
Right.
And that some people react much more strongly and get much more upset and really want what they can't have more than others. So he had been studying that previously before I met him. And then I had been studying separately what happens when the environment kind of activates these non-conscious goals in you and how you can start pursuing these goals outside of your awareness.
Give me an example, Tanya.
If every time you go to school, let's say you're in high school, every time you go to school, you have a goal to achieve. Well, after a while, the goal to achieve becomes linked in memory with the school environment, the books, the teachers,
right.
You know, just the school itself. So that after a while, you don't have to consciously think, I'm at school. Now it's really important that I study hard and do well. The school environment automatically activates that goal in you. So then you start trying to achieve, maybe being a little bit more competitive, trying to work hard without having to consciously decide on that.
So it could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. You're just trying to figure out what that link is. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the triggers, one of the environmental triggers for these non-conscious goals are significant others in our lives. So there had been some research by myself and others showing that when you're exposed to significant others, you tend to automatically do what they want you to do or what you normally do when you're with them.
What's a significant other now? Would that be someone who you have a personal relationship with, or could that be your boss or a colleague?
It could be your boss. I mean, the way it's sort of, if you take a broad definition of significant others, it's people that play a significant role in your life in some way. They may not know you well, but you know them well. So a boss is a good example there, where your boss may not consider you a significant other if they're supervising many, many people.
Right.
But
they walk
you,
into the room and everybody sits up straight.
Yeah,
and they have a significant influence on.
Yeah. Normally, when we use the term significant other, we tend to think more about relationship partners, close friends, family members.
How do you test this? What did you guys come up with as a way of making this work?
One thing we wanted to do is establish how reactant are the people in our study. So we give them a scale that actually measures how reactant folks are. And you can say some folks are on the high end, some folks are on the low end.
Is this a series of questions you would ask them?
Just things like, when someone tells me I cannot do something, I really would like to do it.
So there's a series of questions that tests how reactant people are. And then once you've got them mapped on this little scale of how reactant they are, what can you do to provoke or to test how quickly they respond?
We bring in the participants and we have them sit in front of a computer. And the first thing we do is we ask them about some of their significant others and what those significant others want them to do. So we said, give us the first name of an important person in your life who really wants you to work hard. Give us the first name of a person in your life who really wants you to relax and have fun.
So it could be a mother. It could be a husband, a wife. Okay, right.
Exactly. And so they listed these names for us, and then we had them engage in this vigilance task where they're telling us where flashes on the screen are appearing, and they're told that this is to test visual acuity. But what we were actually doing was flashing the name of one of their significant others, either the person that they told us wanted them to work hard or the name of the person that they had told us previously wanted them to have fun and relax. So these were subliminal flashes. They couldn't consciously see them. They just thought they were flashes on the screen.
So you plant that name in their mind, and then what?
And then we want to see, well, how hard do they work? Do they do what that person wants them to do, or do they do the opposite? And so we gave them some anagrams where you're just unscrambling these words. The low reactant people,
the easygoing people
like me, they automatically start doing what that person wants them to do. So if they were flashed with the person who wants them to work hard, they really worked hard on this mind task. If they were flashed with the person who wants them to relax, they didn't try so hard. So they did what that person would want them to do, even though they had no awareness of seeing this person's name. But if they were highly reactant, they did the opposite. The reactant folks automatically did the opposite of what this significant other wanted them to do.
Okay, so now we know what we're talking about, but how easy is it to do something about it? Tanya Chartrand will be back in a moment, along with her husband and colleague Gavin Fitzsimmons. At least I think he'll be here, as long as that suggestion comes from me and not from Tanya. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There is a little bit more to this kind of stubbornness we're calling reactance in today's conversation. Tanya Chartrand and Gavin Fitzsimmons are married. They are also professors of psychology at Duke. And they did a clinical study to ascertain if people actually do have a kind of subconscious reluctance to do whatever it is their spouse or their parent might want them to do. Gavin says he's known for years that he had this kind of tendency.
I was a graduate student at Columbia at the time, and I was living in an apartment near Columbia, and I went out one night to the local deli, which was underneath my building, to grab some 2-liter Diet Coke. And it was wintertime, and it was kind of drizzly, but the deli was right underneath the building. So I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt and a pair of shoes. And I went into the store, and I went to the section where the 2-liter Diet Coke was, and it was an empty section. So I sort of had that moment of, where's the 2-liter Diet Coke?
Yeah, yeah.
And I said to the fellow behind the counter, can you grab me some 2-liter Diet Coke from the back? And he said, no, we're all out, but I'll give you 2 1-liter bottles for the same price as a 2-liter bottle. And I paused for a moment, and I thought to myself, well, I don't want 2 1-liter bottles. I want a 2-liter bottle. So I left in a huff, started walking up the street. You know, it's New York, so there's a deli every block.
In shorts and a t-shirt
in January in the drizzle and the rain. Went into the next deli. There were none. I went into the third deli a block up. There was no 2-liter Diet Coke. So finally, I walk across campus to the other side of the university. I go into the deli. They have it. I bought 6 of them. So now I'm walking back. I'm soaked to the skin, carrying 3 2-liter bottles in both arms. My arms are starting to stretch down to, you know, to the ground. I get halfway across the walk back and I stopped and I thought, what just happened? And what had just happened, of course, was that I'd experienced my own reactants loud and clear, where, boy, I wanted that 2-liter Diet Coke, and the more I couldn't have the 2-liter Diet Coke, the more I wanted it, and it just kept feeding on itself.
But it turns into this bizarre quest.
Totally bizarre quest, totally irrational, right?
Yeah.
I could have had 2 liters of it in 2 separate containers, which one might argue would be better.
In 30 seconds.
For the same price, it stayed dry and warm and been happy, and yet it led to this very bizarre behavior. So, you know, there are many examples like that where this desire to maintain this ability to choose and the freedom to have these things can lead to these really detrimental or negative effects.
So what was it like for the two of you when you went through all the data and realized that the suspicions you had going into it, in fact, were being borne out by the way people behaved in front of the computers?
Well, that's sort of one of the most exciting parts of being a researcher and academic, is sitting down with that data after you've run the study. And Tanya and I sat down with our doctoral student, Amy Dalton, who's been a collaborator on this project and did a superb job with us, and the three of us sat down, and you know, you hit that button for the first time and pop, out come the results, and we all went, wow, really? check that again.
It's,
you know,
true.
Make sure that's right, you know. And so we started testing for the robustness of it, and sure enough, the more we dug, the harder we looked at it, and the more robust it was. And so we ran basically 2 variants of the study. So we ran it twice to make sure, in fact, that we were confident that this was a real thing, and sure enough, it held up really strongly in both venues.
Did you celebrate?
That's a great question. Other than, you know, the excitement and the high fives in the office, I don't know if we... it's possible. I'm always looking for an excuse to open a good bottle of wine at night,
yes.
So that's quite a possibility.
We probably did that.
What did it change just in your own relationship, though? I mean, you both knew that you had this tendency towards, in your case, Tanya, being easygoing, low reactant, and Gavin, in your case, you know, lots of buttons to push, I guess. But when you figured out, oh, my God, this happens to me unconsciously, as well as something that I'm aware of, does it make it any easier for you guys to face it?
Well, we laugh a little bit about that because I think our conclusions are somewhat different on this point. So from my perspective as the reactant guy, I sort of feel that if this is all occurring outside my conscious awareness, all I need to do is hear Tanya's voice or see a photo of her, be reminded of her in some way, and I'm automatically going to start doing things that she would not want me to do.
So what does this mean, that you're not responsible
for
your behavior?
You got it. There we go, Dick. I like it. So, yes, he's seen the true insight here, the true conclusion.
People listening can't see your eyes rolling. You'll have to explain your perspective here.
Well, I just think that the first step to controlling something or changing something is being aware of it and understanding the source or the origin of the behavior, in this case, the automatic behavior. And, you know, I understand it's tough to change automatic responses. We all have habits that we don't like, these automatic, you know, habit to smoke or habit to drink or, you know, whatever it is we wish we didn't do. So I understand how hard it is. But I think if you want to have any hope of changing the negative behavior or the unwanted response, understanding it, knowing where it comes from, is the first step. And then you can start to say, okay, well, I'm going to have this instinct. I know I'm going to have this instinct, but
let the record show you're looking at Gavin.
Yeah, that's right. Let me take a step back and try to.
But I get what you're saying as well. It's like, if you know it's there, deal with it. Don't you know, back off and say, hey, I'm clean. It's that, you know, devil on my left shoulder, right?
Right, exactly.
So since you ran the data, since you've done the work, has anything changed around the dinner table?
I suspect not.
Probably not. You know, one thing I think we're both pretty good at, especially me, is really separating what we do at work from our home life. And the irony is I do a lot of research that's pretty applicable to my own life. And yet I go home and turn it all off and then, you know, kind of forget about it. I think more than I should. I don't think I...
But if you didn't want Gavin to wear the brown shirt to that party...
Well,
then
I've learned...
Why don't you say, Gavin, wear that brown shirt?
Yeah,
it
right.
looks so good on you, and you know he won't put it on.
It's true that you learn, I think, if you are married to someone or if someone important in your life is highly reactant, you develop sort of strategies of dealing with it over time. And I certainly don't tell him, you need to do X. I just won't. I won't say that to him.
Because you know exactly what the response is going to be. Pavlovian.
Exactly. And I think even probably even before we began this research, I sort of developed ways of dealing with it.
So, Gavin, can you say to Tanya, or can you say even to yourself, if only she had put it this way?
Yeah, it's funny. I think it so rarely enters my consciousness that I'm being reactant that it's hard for me to do that. So I just feel, let's say Tanya had asked me to pick up the milk on the way home, I just have this feeling like, well, geez, I'm so busy and I have all these other things to do and I just don't have time to pick up the milk. I don't think to myself, if Tanya had simply said to me, hey, is there anything that we need at home? I would have spontaneously said, well, we were running low on milk. Why don't I stop and pick it up? Now I can do that. I can step back and do it. But in the moment, I'm so focused on sort of preserving all my options to take whatever path I would like to take that I have difficulty stepping back. And I think probably all the folks out there that are reactant will probably can empathize with that.
I'll take it one step further with the two of you because you are both experts in marketing. You're both teaching at Duke's Business School. You are both psychologists. So, I mean, I can imagine this. What should I say? Why is she saying what she's saying? Am I supposed to react this way? You know, it sort of becomes a blender of reinterpretation. I don't know. If you at some point have to push the pause button and go, wait a minute, let's just start this all over again.
But I think it's a coping strategy for me because of that to just turn things off when I go home and not be thinking so much about how does all the research I know about and do myself apply to this situation. I think it would drive me crazy, which is probably why over time I've developed the strategy. Like I go home, I turn it off, I just deal with him.
Yeah.
And it maybe in some situations it's to my disadvantage because if I did think about it and apply it, it would help the situation. But I think it's a coping strategy. I think it's a survival thing. I'd just be too overwhelmed because we do know a lot about psychology and social psychology, how people relate to each other. And I think it would get overwhelming very quickly.
Yeah, I find it hard to step out of, it's almost like a stepping out of body and you know, watching yourself from above and thinking to yourself, well, what would be the right strategy here, given all that we know about the research? And neither of us is willing to admit that we do that on a regular basis. So it's hard. Now, you know, can we apply what we know to, you know, our children? It's funny. I think we try a little more in that department.
How old are your kids?
We have an 8-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Okay, so the 1-year-old's just about to hit the like super toddler reactant stage where every yes means no.
He's solidly right in it right now. We spell N-O around the house because if he hears it, even if it's not directed at him,
that means
he simply starts screaming. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and if you take something away from him, try to limit his freedom. I think he's like his dad. And he'll just look straight at you and scream until you let him do what he wants.
How much of this in your own sense of who's reacting and who's not is a boy-girl thing? Because, I mean, in your own case, it's Gavin who has this reaction. But in the cases that I'm imagining with brothers and friends, it is more often the guy than the girl. Am I wrong with that?
No, it's actually very interesting. So prior to this work that we've been doing on relationship reactants, there had been some research done to look at just in general, like do men or women respond to those questions? You know, are they going to respond to the questions differently? And it turns out that they don't. So women are equally as reactant. You sort of think about your 14-year-old daughter versus your 14-year-old son. They're equally as reactant in those situations to a stock out at a store, not being able to, you know, get a certain drink or something like that. But it certainly seems to be the case, and we don't have enough data yet to really definitively say, but certainly seems to be the case that in relationship settings, adults relating with other adults, it tends to be the case, at least from all the sort of stuff we've collected and the anecdotes that everybody's sharing with us, that men tend to be more reactant in relationships than women do.
Would you agree with that, Tanya?
Anecdotally, absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Almost everyone that's heard about this research has, and then shared mm-hmm. personal stories,
yeah.
It's almost always the husband or the, you know, boyfriend that's the reactant
one. And people will also be wondering, I bet, because I am, how that changes over time. If a couple that's been together for 10 years or 20 or 30 years has somehow figured out ways of either, as you were saying, Tanya, you know, navigating around this, or if Gavin, attitudes actually change. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, we do have some data that says that as people get older, they become less reactant. So in theory, Gavin as a 60-year-old should be more manageable than Gavin as a 39-year-old, in theory.
Fingers crossed.
So that's the good news.
Look at it. You'll just be slower. Someone will get to the door before you.
But it seems that it almost by definition must be the case that relationships that make it 50 years mm-hmm. have managed to work out coping strategies for dealing with right. this somewhat difficult trait. I'm willing to concede it's somewhat difficult at times.
Gavin Fitzsimmons and Tanya Chartrand are the authors of a study called Non-Conscious Relationship Reactance When Significant Others Prime Opposing Goals. Or in more layperson terms, why he does what he does, and is it him or is it me? You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. So one question is, can we predict over time with such a couple? Is there going to be some kind of balancing out? Will one person become a little bit more decisive while the other becomes a little less demanding?
I don't know. It'd be speculation, but that seems like very reasonable that would yeah. be one thing that could evolve over time, that the indecisive / non-reactant person may end up becoming more comfortable with decision-making or try to assert themselves more often just to kind of balance the situation out a little bit more.
Or, you know, as scientists, we're never supposed to do this, but, you know, projecting from our own experience, I think, rather than the number of decisions changing, the shift in the number of decisions, as we've been together longer, the shift in the weight of the decisions has changed. So let's say we're making 10 decisions in a day and one's really important. When we first started dating, I would want all 10 decisions.
Right, but and you now, were less well-skilled at knowing which ones were important.
Exactly,
exactly.
And so over time, I've learned which decisions will Tanya care about.
Right.
And so if there's 10 decisions in a day and one she'll care about, I am willing now, at least a little bit, she may give me some credit on this, to recognize that she cares about this one issue and to soften my reactant position with that. And I think we've seen that already over the course of our relationship. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that, you know, either the total number shifts or yeah. some way the weight might shift so that the non-reactant person really gets to choose when it's important to them, you know, big decisions, you know, house do we live in, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
That's right. And ideally, you know, you could imagine that the highly reactant person would train themselves to care less about the issues that their partner really cared about.
You'd like to think that
would
do that.
If you could do that, yeah. that would be good because, you know, you don't really care as much about those less important decisions and having freedom to choose there.
But that's just a gesture of affection. That's just saying,
exactly.
Hey, I'm not going to, you know, drive you crazy all the time.
Just part of the time, exactly.
Where do you go next? What are you working on? What are you thinking about now? Do you take this another step further, or have we got, you know, the how reactant are you pretty well maxed out at this point?
You know, one thing that would be interesting to me is what can turn off this reactant tendency among highly reactant people? Is there something in the environment that can, on an automatic level, shut it down or turn it off? For me, that would be really yeah. important to find out. And I don't know if anything like that exists But, you know, there's other directions we could take it, I think,
as well.
Yeah,
no, it's interesting to think about if you're reacting in one domain, and as Tanya says, perhaps if you get an opportunity to exercise that reactance in an unimportant domain right before the important choice right. gets made.
Go play a video game. Go and kill a bunch of people on a flat screen somewhere and then come back and have a decent conversation.
Perhaps that'll happen. And I think, right. you know, the issue you alluded to earlier about the dynamics over time about what happens with reactant individuals over time. And I'm very interested in why we all start as reactant individuals at age 13 and 14. And some of us, you know, men and women,
Don't outgrow it.
We stay reactant. No one really knows why that is and what it is about those people that leads them to stay that way versus those that move away from it and outgrow it relatively quickly. You know, as soon as they're out of their teenage years, they outgrow it. And I think that's a fascinating question. You know, maybe it might help me outgrow it slightly at this point if I could figure that out.
Thank you both for coming in. It's been fun talking about this.
Well,
thanks
very
much,
Dick.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
In September, Tanya and Gavin had their third child, this one a baby girl named Fiona. Gavin tells me she has all the signs of being as laid back and non-reactant as her mom. Tanya Chartrand and Gavin Fitzsimmons both teach at Duke University. They are professors of marketing and psychology. This music is appropriate to end this story. This is My One and Only Love with John Coltrane on the sax. Coming up next, a conversation about John Coltrane. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. Dick Gordon, this is The Story. There's a new series of audio documentaries available about John Coltrane and, among other songs, about John Coltrane's favorite things. Producer Joe Vella is the man behind this series of podcast documentaries. He spent months tracking down people who played with Coltrane and asking them about their memories. We have a link where you can find all of Joe's work. It's on our website at thestory.org. Today, though, Joe has agreed to give us just a peek inside. His first interview was with the pianist McCoy Tyner. McCoy was just a teenager when he met Coltrane. He played with him during a time when Coltrane's music was increasingly experimental. In fact, Coltrane became McCoy Tyner's mentor, and that's why Joe Vella spoke with him.
Our discussion focused a lot, very personal, actually. It wasn't so much about the music. He loved John Coltrane. We talked mainly. We didn't even tape it. We talked for a while. I told him about the project. I wanted to get his blessing. He was into it. And then we decided to meet at the end, and I would sit with him for a couple of hours. I got in a hold of a few excerpts of a John Coltrane interview. You'd be surprised. Not many people have ever heard John Coltrane's voice.
When was he recorded?
This was recorded in Sweden in 1960, right before McCoy probably would have been playing with him. I had clipped out three pieces that sort of talk, you know, that I could use, that Coltrane was just talking about his playing, and he was kind of capturing him at a really interesting time. He was kind of coming into his own and talking about it. And I sequenced, you know, six or seven pieces of Coltrane's music in and out of John talking. And after McCoy and I talked, I said, I just want to play this piece. So I took out my iPod and I gave him a pair of headsets, and he sat there and he listened to it.
I was talking to a fellow today, and I told him that the reason I play so many, it sounds angry because I'm I'm trying so many things at one time, you see. Like, I haven't sorted them out. I have a whole bag of things that I'm trying to.
I heard it was over. Took off the headphones. He didn't say a word. He kind of looked down. His eyes were very, very, you know, kind of moist, we'll say. And he looked up at me, and he said, "Thank you. It's so nice to hear John's voice again." And that was it. It took me back. It was like I got a blow to the gut. It really touched him in a way that I would never have thought. But just hearing Coltrane's voice again triggered that boy in McCoy thinking of his older brother and missing him. You know, he hadn't heard his voice in many, many years. I knew from that point on it was going to be a wonderful experience. It was going to be something to take hold. I mean, impersonally for me, to go in and talk to everybody about John Coltrane. That I knew from seeing McCoy's face and seeing that he was emotionally moved by just that little piece that was really, you know, quickly put together, that this music, this man, his message impacts people in ways more than music.
And I want our listeners to hear just a little bit of McCoy Tyner. This is something that you put together. We're hearing My Favorite Things with the voice of Tyner over top of that.
I don't know when he heard the song, actually, My Favorite Things, and I think it was a very, very popular song, actually, at the time. He chose that as a song that we could elaborate on musically. You do a sort of a vamp version of it, which I thought was a good idea, because it gave us a chance to expound on theme and to do our own thing within that context, you know, so that we didn't lose the character of the song. But at the same time, we had the freedom to do what we wanted to do with it, because it was a band. I love the fact that he played soprano. I thought it was a good contrast to him just playing the tenor.
You know, Joe, one of the things that I was wondering in listening to McCoy and just hearing you talk about Coltrane, were you in any way intimidated about going into a project looking at John Coltrane? I mean, here is a jazz musician who has probably been more studied, more revered, more admired, and more, there's been more written about him than, you know, many of the others put together.
I don't even think about it. I'm just curious, and I try not to think about it. It's about the story. It's about the content. It's about the music that we're incorporating in the story. I think the trick is you just try to go in there and just ask the logical questions, and then from the responses opens up the real questions.
You are a musician yourself, right?
Yes, my father played the drums as a casual musician, playing weddings and so forth. I got to be a natural drummer around 8.
Playing your dad's drums?
My dad's drums in the garage. And then I met a bunch of kids in high school. I was a younger kid, so I was 13. And we all liked jazz, and we just played together. That's all we did from the age 13 through high school. We just played jazz and bought records in those days.
There weren't a lot of garage bands that were into jazz.
Yeah, we played actually as backup bands for the pop, you know, kind of dance hall groups, but we played jazz and we were mastering our instruments all the time. You'd be surprised. You start studying jazz on a full-time scale, you could play anything. That's the coolest thing about being a jazz musician is most jazz musicians can play any style of music. They're technically there, but also they have a feel. They're intuitive. You teach yourself how to do that through playing.
But it's still a little bit unconventional. I have to think that there must have been people who said, "Yeah, play some Led Zeppelin for us, and we don't want to hear your jazz."
Where's Kiss? Where's Led Zeppelin? Oh, it happened all the time. What do you think? Do you think we had a social life? We just played music and jazz and studied and went to this club in San Francisco called Keystone Corner. It was the only club that served food, allowed minors in. So one of our parents would take us, and we'd go and see. In fact, I saw tons of people, Ahmed Jamal and Stan Getz and Bill Evans. We saw Wynton Marsalis when he was just a boy. We were actually seniors in high school, and Wynton came on the scene. He was 17 years or 18 years old, playing with Art Blakey. we were really right there. There was a real thing going on with jazz in the late 70s into the 80s.
And do you any recollection from that time, Joe, when you first heard John Coltrane?
I actually heard John Coltrane first through the radio at my house. My father would play K-Jazz Radio, which was a very weak FM signaled station based in Alameda, California. And I first recall noticing John Coltrane playing on the ballad from Miles Davis's Kind of Blue called Flamenco Sketches. He plays a beautiful, very, very moody solo that is very John Coltrane. And it really is, you know, still one of my favorite tracks to return to.
You still close your eyes and get the same amount of pleasure out of it today as you did when you heard it the first time.
Absolutely. I mean, what can you say more than that? Just listen to that. That should tell you a lot about the man right
there.
Ease
with the way he plays that instrument. I mean, that's the part that fascinates me. And I know that as a part of your own study of the man and your conversation with people, you did the due diligence of talking to the people who are jazz aficionados and really understand where he fits. But you did something else. You went and found people who sat in the clubs and just listened to the man. What did they have to tell you? What could they teach you?
Well, there was actually two John Coltranes I learned. There was the Coltrane that we who didn't see him live thought we knew. And then there was the live Coltrane. Everybody, I mean, it really is kind of strange. Everybody said it was like going to church. Not a denominational kind of church, but it was a spiritual kind of experience. The energy on the stage, the piano, bass, and drums, and then Coltrane. You would sit in the club, and he would sit there and blow for 45 minutes. And your jaw would just open up basically after about 10 minutes. And you'd think he'd walk off the stage, and he would almost just be kind of warming up. And he would play and play and play and play, and the band would play and play and play and play. The drummer, Elvin Jones, would be sweating profusely, the drumsticks slipping out of his hands, the drums moving off the stage. He'd be playing so ferociously. The bass player, Jimmy Garrison, they would be playing many times at very fast paced kinds of tempos. And sometimes McCoy would just drop out because he just couldn't play anymore. He'd be done. He'd exhaust whatever they were playing, as would Jimmy Garrison in the case of a very, very fast tempo. And just it would be just Elvin Jones and Coltrane playing for another 10 minutes. And they'd have this energy, and it would work and work and work into this frenzy. And the band would come back in, of course, when the Coltrane would cue them in. But other times, during the live setting, what Coltrane would do, especially when he was experimenting in the sort of harmonic development, he would be playing stuff and it would start to go out of the scale. And there would be no changes in the music. And he would be pushing the limits of the music by just improvising and going into free forms. And there would be no chords for a guy like McCoy to even know what to play. So he would have to just, they'd be vamping. He'd just have to lay out. It was really quite amazing. Everybody who witnessed the experience said they couldn't believe it. They still have never seen anything like it, and they can't get it out of their mind, that whole experience. And it was something that you would just, you'd go back for more, and you wouldn't even know what you were going to see. You wouldn't care. It was just sort of this enlightened thing that that band had on audiences. Thank you.
We're listening now to Coltrane live at the Half Note in New York, the name of the piece, One Up, One Down. I love the story of the music producers who tried to record the music that was being played there, and they kept running out of tape on their machines. I'm talking with the music documentary producer Joe Vella about the interviews he conducted with people who saw John Coltrane live. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Here's one more clip from Joe Vella's documentary series, the jazz pianist Steve Kuhn talking about his recollection of John Coltrane and one of Coltrane's curious addictions.
He had this sugar craving, and he used to eat these butter rum lifesavers. But, I mean, he just popped one in after the other. So he, instead of a cologne, all you'd smell was the butter rums. But that's how every time I smell those things, I immediately think of him and I can see him.
One of my favorite quotes, Joe, is from the historian Barbara Tuchman, who wrote an essay once called History by the Ounce, and in fact said at that time that if you could identify the brand and the smell of the pipe tobacco that the general who was commanding the troops was smoking at the time, then you were going to bring people closer to it. And listening to Steve, I'm thinking to myself, I'll never smell butter rum lifesavers again without thinking just a little bit of John Coltrane.
Yeah, that was actually a wonderful session with Steve. Steve played the piano right before Mokoy Tyner joined the band, and he was he had the fortune of actually really kind of hanging out with John Coltrane a couple, three times, just he and Train playing music, not really talking much, but... hearing those kinds of stories and you know, I feel very fortunate to be able to actually put it into a context where people can kind of get a sense of John Coltrane. And in this case, you get a scent of John Coltrane.
Joe Vella is an audio producer from Connecticut. You can find out how to get Joe's podcast documentary series on John Coltrane. Just log on to thestory.org. Now, we started this part of the program by listening to My Favorite Things, and we'll end there as well. This is a recording of Coltrane at the Village Vanguard in 1966. I should warn you that Coltrane's live recordings run a little bit long for even an hour-long radio program, so we'll just think of this as one of his favorite things. If you have a suggestion for a story for us or one of your own that you'd like to tell, then go to our website at thestory.org. Leave me a short note there. Or you can call and leave me a message on our toll-free telephone line. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Thank you.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.